Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you O'Farrell, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be, in the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more bore for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud walled cabin eyes were watching through the night. Many a manly chest was throbbing for the blessed warning light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the banshee's lonely crew, and the thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest homeland, comrades. It's October the 21st, 2010. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. We've got very little by way of an Edgar Steele update this week, since we're still waiting for the trial to begin on November the 1st. The original Free Edgar Steele website reports that Ed was allowed a visit recently by a supporter, and he still seems to be holding up, with no sign that he's going to break. I have to assume that the pressure for Ed Steele to knuckle under and accept some kind of plea bargain was very intense at one stage, and maybe still is. He may or may not be aware that his wife Cindy and his mother-in-law, whom he's been accused of conspiring to kill, are now clearly in his corner and giving him all the support they can, but evidently the pressure hasn't succeeded, and Steele is still going to fight the case and not plead out, even if all he has is a court-appointed lawyer. The family of Ed Steele launched a fund appeal about a month ago in order to try and raise some real money, something like $250,000, in order to hire an actual skilled attorney to defend him and not some flack in a cheap suit who's going to be paid his salary by the very government that's trying to destroy Steele. So far, they've only been able to raise about $20,000, and according to the FES site, they're considering using that money to try and hire an expert to listen to the alleged tapes of Steele trying to hire Fairfax as a hitman and determine how and at what point they were doctored, as in my opinion, they certainly were. I think one of the most significant aspects of this case is that, to the best of my knowledge, no one who actually knows Edgar Steele personally has for one moment entertained the notion that he's guilty. There is simply too much about the Fed's case against him that just plain does not make sense. But mostly, it's the whole idea of Edgar Steele doing anything like that at all which simply doesn't ring true to anyone who knows him at all. Character aside, there isn't any financial motive, since Steele was known to have a small fortune in gold and silver on his property. And indeed, apparently Fairfax stealing some of that gold and silver is part and parcel of the case. But Steele was not in any financial trouble. Rather the reverse. You might say he had an embarrassment of riches. One thing that has come out is that as of about a week ago, the defense still has not been given access to all the tapes which are to be used against Steele in court, which, of course, is completely against legal norms and accepted courtroom procedure. But since Ed Steele is a so-called white supremacist, whatever the hell that means, the normal laws and protections don't apply to him. Once the trial starts and we actually get to hear the famous tapes and get a look at the infamous Larry Fairfax, obviously we'll have a lot more to say. Of course, 2 weeks from now, I'll also have a lot to say about the results of the midterm elections. There's another case I wish I could update you guys on, but there's nothing new at all on it. The anniversary of Jeff Hughes' murder in Vancouver, Canada, is coming up on Saturday, October the 23rd. For those of you who came in late and don't know who Jeff Hughes is, or was, he was the head of our sister movement in the Great White North, Northwest Front Canada. On the early morning of October 23, 2009, a female officer of the Royal Canadian Mounted Police fired 10 bullets into Jeff as he stepped out the door of his apartment building on Vancouver Island. The RCMP do not claim that Jeff was armed or acting aggressively or drunk or stoned. They don't claim anything. They ship the woman officer off to Ontario somewhere and refuse even to name her or anyone else involved in the incident. This woman emptied her gun into an unarmed man, and then everybody just walked away and left Jeff Hughes dead on the sidewalk. And that was that. No, really, I'm not making this up. That's what happened. So far, no coroner's inquest, no official police inquiry, no nothing. The RCMP just gunned Jeff down and walked away, and that seems to be that. What gets me is that there hasn't even been a coroner's inquest, which I believe is completely illegal under Canadian law. As always happens in a democracy, whenever a white nationalist is involved, they simply ignore their own rules and regulations, and all the lefty civil liberties types who'd be screaming a roof down if it were a Jew or a brown-skinned minority involved are as quiet as little church mice. In the interest of accuracy, I need to clarify that although I knew Jeff for almost 7 years via the internet, I never met him personally, much to my regret. We never got the chance. He was barred from entering the United States because of an old criminal record he had from about 25 years ago, and I'm banned from entering Canada because of my novels, which are also banned in Canada, by the way. You won't be arrested if they catch you trying to take a copy of The Brigade across the border, but Canadian customs will confiscate it. And so I assume that if my books aren't considered kosher for Canadian consumption, then neither would I be if I ever tried to enter the country. Maybe one day I'll try it just to see what would happen. Anyway, Jeff and I never got to meet, but for many years we communicated regularly, usually every couple of days, by email, chat room, telephone, sometimes by video, virtually every way you can get to know a man in this day and age without actually being in the same room with him. And most of you are aware of the fact that on the whole, I don't think much of the internet. However, after about 15 years, I've developed some skill in detecting when somebody's BSing me. I'm sure most of you have some idea of what I mean. Most of us by now can judge an internet contact after a fairly short time and tell whether or not they're running some kind of game on us, or they're lying, or just plain full of it. Jeff was never like that. He rang true every time. Let me put it this way. Jeff Hughes was one of the very few people I ever met in the white nationalist movement that nobody ever said anything bad about. And if you know our movement at all, you'll understand how rare that is. Even his Indian neighbors up there on Selby Street, who knew about his National Socialist beliefs, had good things to say about him to the Vancouver media when they came nosing around after he was murdered. I make no mistake, Jeff Hughes was a real loss. He wasn't just one of those useless net Nazis who hang around the V-Bulletin boards under an alias and nobody knows who or where they are or what they do for the cause, if anything. Jeff stood up and resisted. He passed out leaflets and put up stickers and posted all over the internet, and above all, he talked to people personally. And in Canada, that's a deadly dangerous thing for a white man to do. Jeff especially loathed these god-awful human rights tribunals that the Canadian regime uses to suppress and punish dissent and thought crime among white Canadians. And more than once, he rode hundreds of miles on a bus all over BC and Alberta just to sit in the audience when someone was being persecuted and destroyed by these ghastly kangaroo courts, just so there would be at least one friendly face there to support whoever was being victimized by Richard Warman or whatever kike brought the complaint. The thing we need to understand about the case is that Jeff was already well known to the RCMP before they shot him. This wasn't a confrontation with some unknown subject. He was an open nationalist, and he'd been visited repeatedly by various kinds of Canadian political police, including a few weeks before he was killed by a man named Sergeant Sean McGowan from the British Columbia Hate Crime Squad, who, according to what I hear, are the Ottawa regime's chief head knockers in the province in charge of suppressing racial dissent on the part of European Canadians. Based on what Jeff told me about that, it's my personal belief that the possibility can't be discounted that Jeff was killed for the same reason the FBI attacked and murdered Randy Weaver's family on Ruby Ridge in 1992. Cops hate it when people refuse to become snitches, and they can be very vindictive about it, especially in custodial situations. The Northwest Front has a woman comrade named Pam Bailey who's now being held in solitary confinement in Oregon, possibly for the next 4 years until her sentence ends, due to a pattern of official harassment based on her refusal to become an informant. Ironically, she and Jeff were corresponding when he was murdered. Police and prison officers hate worse than anything to be told to piss off when they order somebody to rat out. It challenges their authority and their petty self-esteem almost as much as an assault. Like all bullies, cops and FBI tend to freak out when anybody stands up to them. The upshot of all this is that Jeff's address had to be red flagged, or whatever the Canadian term for it is. The RCMP had to know who was in that apartment. Another thing, why did the RCMP, the Canadian National Police Force itself, send a full armed response team, including dogs, to investigate a domestic disturbance call? In Canada, there are local police departments just like there are down here. According to the official version of events, or one official version anyway, since it keeps changing. Anyway, the original call to the police was a noise complaint about some Indian dopers playing loud rap music. And yet it was the almighty horsemen themselves who showed up, fully armed and in full body armor and gear. Now, down here in the States, you don't send the FBI or the SWAT team to respond to domestic dispute calls, unless the cops know that there's most likely something a lot heavier going to go down. So that whole business of Dudley Do-Right and the Mounties rocking up at 6 in the morning looks excessive. Looks more like a dawn raid to me. One more thing I'd like to get into. There's something that angers and disturbs me about all this almost as much as Jeff's actual death, although it may sound a bit irrelevant. Those of you on the Northwest Revolution list who remember Jeff will probably recall a number of appeals from both Jeff Hughes and myself down through the years, practically getting down on our knees and begging some of our Canadian comrades to step forward, to make the move to Western Canada and the Vancouver area in particular, and help Jeff with his work for the NF. No one ever responded. Jeff had Canadian comrades, of course, all of whom liked and respected him, but just like here, they were scattered all over his huge country, and his nearest friends were several hours away. Now, after he was killed, one of Jeff's neighbors posted a more or less eyewitness account of the whole incident to Stormfront, which, in view of the fact that Stormfront is Richard Warman's happy hunting ground, probably required a bit of courage, and don't get me wrong, I appreciate this person's coming forward. But the fact is that after all of this time begging and pleading for someone local to come forward and help Jeff, or even move to the Canadian Northwest homeland itself to help him, it turns out that Jeff had a fellow white nationalist living right across the street from him, and yet they never even knew of one another's existence. The same thing applies to all of us. We all complain about the isolation of being a lone nationalist in a sea of political correctness, and yet for all we know, we could have half a dozen comrades living within a couple of miles of us. That's one reason for our email contact list that the Front publishes, and so far we have, I think, 134 people out of a list of several thousand who are willing to publish their email addresses and receive contacts with a view towards personal meeting. And if that doesn't say something about the quality of the people we get in the movement, I don't know what does. Anyway, it's been a year now. Nothing has been done, and pretty obviously nothing will be done until we achieve the Northwest Republic. I don't know what the main drag in Vancouver is called, but someday it's going to be Jeff Hughes Avenue. And there is going to be a big-ass statue of Jeff right in front of the British Columbia Provincial Parliament building, or better yet, right in front of the old RCMP headquarters. We miss you, comrade. I was looking around for something Canadian and subversive to play on the anniversary of Jeff's murder, and I think I found it. This is Steve Earle. Still hung in the air, no
by one, the witnesses came, and I told him what I wanted to know, justice in Ontario.
Something else happened this week, which gets into another subject I've been meaning to touch on for a while. My primary computer that I use is about 12 years old, or at least parts of it are. It originally started life as a high school science project built by some kid in Texarkana, although most of its components have been replaced down through the years. I had another problem with it this week, which took it down for a couple of days. Not a virus this time, a hardware glitch that turned out to be easy to put right once my Cybermeister figured out what it was. Furthermore, thanks to the generosity of one individual supporter, I now at long last have a backup computer, and so I wasn't cut off from the communications completely during this period. I've transferred most of my necessary software and files to the new machine, and if need be, I can produce and upload Radio Free Northwest off it. This is a vast improvement in the party's technological capacity, and I really thank the gentleman who provided the necessary scratch for it. Eventually, this second computer will become the workstation of that personal assistant I keep fantasizing about. However, all of that having been said, I'm afraid I've got to revert for a bit to one of my old roles as the movement's Eeyore. Listen carefully. We are going to lose the internet someday. I know, nobody believes me. I've been prophesying doom and gloom on this for years, and so have a lot of other people, and it still hasn't happened, as witness the fact that you're listening to my voice right now. Everybody has come to shrug off these repeated warnings, and they figure anybody who's concerned about it is just being paranoid. We've come to accept the internet as so much a part of our lives that nowadays a lot of us simply can't remember and can't imagine what life would be without it. Fair enough. So far, us paranoids aren't betting too well on this one. But I say to you again, we are going to lose the internet someday, at least in the form that we know it and understand it. The time is going to come when the power structure is simply going to throw the law and the Constitution out the window and do something to try and silence criticism and communication on the net, because things will have deteriorated to the point where they simply have to. I think the internet is one of the few things that really worries our ruling class these days. And for all its many problems, I've never denied the internet's powerful potential as a weapon against these tyrants. What frightens the politically correct establishment more than anything else about the internet is that for the first time in the past three generations or so, the World Wide Web provides uncontrolled lateral communication between the regime's subject peoples. Like all tyrannies, the United States wants all communication within society to come from the top down, with the Anglo-Zionist ruling class telling the peasantry and the other lower orders what they want them to know and to think and to believe. And there needs to be another line of communication rising from the bottom up, feedback so that the system can keep track of what's going on in people's minds and monitor the results of their propaganda and social engineering. Up and down communication, never side to side or all over the grid like a lot of net stuff is. What the power structure most definitely does not want is lateral communication between the white peasants and industrial serfs and the 1,001 other disaffected elements in America. They don't want us talking directly to one another without data and opinions that have been scrubbed and sanitized through the establishment brain laundry in order to remove any dangerous thoughts and ideas. On the internet, there's nobody to tell us white boys what to think, and that worries our lords and masters. That's what the internet does more than anything else. It enables ordinary people to talk directly to one another without the state or the ruling class as a kind of chaperone. Instead of a nice, polite children's party with all the kiddies making mud pies in the sandbox, you've all of a sudden got something like the bar scene in the first Star Wars movie. Now, a lot of bad has come from that, don't get me wrong. The internet is also a haven for every Looney Tune in the country. And this is a country with a lot of loons. I think the official statistic is still supposed to be that despite all the immense use of cyberspace for every other conceivable purpose, 90% of the internet bandwidth in use today is used for pornography. And it's not as if the government and the courts and the multinational corporations haven't tried to corral the internet already over the past 15 years, either in order to control content and stifle dissent, or else to make a profit off it. I got into the net early enough so that I can still remember when it was just about all free and there were no ads constantly popping up of the kind we have today slowing down your computer all the time that make going to certain websites worse than watching television. During the past 15 years, there have been all kinds of attempts to silence dissent on the net, to restrict the level of communication, to stifle certain ideas and points of view, and above all, to turn it into a money-generating machine in the service of capitalism. As usual, private enterprise has succeeded where government has failed. They've been able to turn the internet into a multi-trillion dollar profit-generating engine and make it by and large just as cheap and garish as Las Vegas, which is a pity for those of us who remember how things used to be. The state and the political class have had a lot less success in controlling the net, but it certainly isn't for lack of trying. For example, how many of you remember from back in the 90s a plan that was floated by the Clinton's Postmaster General to charge a small amount of money, say 0.1 cents, for every email sent? The idea was that email violated the Postal Service's legal monopoly on first-class mail. Of course, in order to collect this fee for the post office, some kind of monitoring device or software would have to be installed on every computer or with the ISPs to keep track of who was emailing what and how much. Needless to say, this would have discouraged excessive emailing, not just spam. Remember, that's one of the reasons the establishment is afraid of the internet and email in particular, because it does provide a form of mass and instantaneous communication between the regime's subject peoples. Obviously, if you have to pay piece rates per email sent, you're going to be doing a lot less emailing. It also pays to remember that the first major advances on the political use of the internet were not websites, but email lists, such as the Zundel revisionist list, and both Stormfront and the Drudge Report got their start not as websites, but as email lists. How many of you remember another thing that they tried after the Oklahoma City bombing in 1995, a little number called H.R. 2580, introduced by Jewish Congressman Charles Schumer, who's now a senator? Schumer was and is notable for his hatred of the Second Amendment and all the gun control laws he kept trying to bring in. But after Oklahoma City, Charlie went after the First Amendment as well, with that bill of his, H.R. 2580, which was deceptively called the Republican Form of Government Guarantee Act. In this bill, Schumer proposed to outlaw discussion of what he called baseless conspiracy theories regarding the government. And there was a whole section devoted to the internet, which gave the government the authority to shut down any website it didn't like and also create a list of people who were banned from using the internet at all. That bill was eventually shot down when all the Clinton scandals started coming out of the woodwork and it became obvious that anything Bill and Hill were connected with was irredeemably contaminated, but it was a close-run thing. I'll give you another and more recent example of an internet control attempt on the part of the regime, and this one may be successful. The Democrats have gotten a lot more open and arrogant and a lot more successful since the Clinton days. About 8 months ago, Congress passed a law giving Obongo a so-called emergency kill switch for the Internet. Now, this conjures up visions of Barry sitting there in the Oval Office with a big switch he can pull in order to shut off the whole Internet, but the fact is that what this act of Congress does is to give the president the legal authority to all ISPs and web hosts in the country to pull the plug on everything in the event of a so-called national emergency. Now, who defines what constitutes a national emergency? You guessed it, the president himself. It goes without saying that Barry Satoru can't be trusted with this kind of power, but this is going to turn out to be one of those laws that if and when a Republican president ever does get into the White House again, somehow he just won't be able to find the time to have it repealed. Every new regime, be it Republican or Democrat, adds more and more of these horrible and unconstitutional laws. Now, they may not use them right away, or if they do, they use them only against dark-skinned foreign Muslims. But they're on the books now, and the United States government and the Office of the Presidency in particular are accumulating tremendous amounts of arbitrary power that the Founding Fathers never intended for them to have. I know I'm wandering off the subject here, guys, but always try to remember that the same laws that neocon Republicans use to torture and imprison and kill Muslims, mostly in foreign countries, can always be turned on white good old boys with baseball caps and pickup trucks by Democrats like Obongo and his Jew crew, or by Republicans for that matter. We need to constantly bear in mind Republicans are no damn better. Indeed, it's already happened. How many people know that Matt Hale is now doing 40 years in a prison cell under a Patriot Act conviction for the crime of typing a single sentence in a private chat room? And that was Republicans who did that. Look, I have got no brief for Muslims at all. They shouldn't be here running all the subways in Atlanta and all the convenience stores in Detroit. They shouldn't be here at all. No argument there. But we need to start understanding how the Jew-controlled government of the United States is exaggerating the so-called Muslim terrorist threat to put into place repressive laws that can be used against anyone and everyone, and that includes us. Pound this into your heads, people. The main enemy are not Muslims. The main enemy, the threat against the white man's very existence, is the Jew, not the Muslim. Never, ever fall into this neoconservative BNP-type error of blaming the Muslims alone for things that are largely the work of the Jews. A prime rule of thumb has to be that the Jews never get off the hook. There's no excuse for a Jew, never. I repeat yet again the famous saying of A.K. Chesterton, if they don't name the Jew, their message isn't true. All right, dragging myself kicking and screaming back to the topic at hand, the people who are seeking to cut us off from the Internet are not Muslims, they're Jews like Charles Schumer, Rahm Emanuel, and Cass Sunstein. Sunstein especially is someone we need to watch out for. He's the one behind the infamous Cognitive Dissonance Program, another government attempt to control or at least derail the Internet as an effective mode of resistance. The story is well worth going over again because it's one of those one-day wonders that appeared in the mainstream media and then it sank out of sight faster than the Titanic. Cass Sunstein is one of those obscure little-known kikes who swim out of a liberal think tank and into the corridors of power. He has a little cubbyhole office somewhere in the West Wing along with some innocuous title like Deputy Communications Director or some such. And yet he quietly exercises an immense influence over that stupid nigger in the Oval Office and government policy as a whole. Now, that's what Jews do best. It's how they rule us like the little man from behind the curtain in The Wizard of Oz. About a year ago, somebody was sufficiently disturbed by what he was doing, so they leaked a number of White House memos to the media, and it came out that when he got into the White House, Sunstein proposed, and apparently with Rahm Emanuel's approval, created a covert ops program which he called Cognitive Dissonance, the object of which was to plant government-paid internet trolls to disrupt selected websites and threads and create dissension, doubt, confusion, and chaos. Not that we don't do a bang-up job messing up our own sites ourselves with all our weird movement dysfunctional crap, but I think we can assume that a lot of the bizarre garbage we see on places like VNN and Stormfront these days comes from these Sunstein cognitive dissonance operatives. Not that it's anything new. The Anti-Defamation League has admitted on several past occasions that they routinely disrupt and harass and otherwise interfere with various internet sites they don't like, including attempts to bring pressure on ISPs to pull down politically incorrect websites that criticize Israel or have unkind things to say about Jews in general. So when you're on some alleged white nationalist website or some comments thread, and you see somebody posting who is clearly simply trying to stir, trying to disrupt, trying to pick a fight, or making some really stupid argument, and pretty clearly he's operating off some kind of strange agenda of his own, just remember, that may well be one of Sunstein's cognitive dissonance crew. I still say, though, that at some point in the future, conditions are going to get so bad in this country that the regime simply isn't going to be able to tolerate open criticism and skepticism anymore from the internet, and they will find a way to shut us down, using the courts, using the police, pressuring the ISPs, making you register your blogs. That idea was floating around for a while. I have no idea how they're going to do it, but they're going to find some way. Now, this is why we in the Northwest Front maintain a print publication, the Northwest Observer. Now, the time may well come when the Northwest Front has to go back to relying on print media with little or no internet communication. I've been telling you guys for years, hang on to those old mimeograph machines in your attics and your garages, the ones you used back in the day when all we had were newsletters that consisted only of a few staple sheets. Hell, even Bob Miles's From the Mountain and most of the early Aryan Nations publications were done on hand-stapled sheets with ragged right margins. But we need to hang on to those old machines and those old skills, people, because we may well need them again. Right, second music break. We've had bagpipes now from Scotland, Ireland, England, and Brittany, and that doesn't leave too much left in the Celtic canon except for Cornwall, and I don't know anything at all about Cornish music. And there's Spanish Galicia, whose bagpipes are pretty much the same as Breton pipes with that same blatting sound. And then there's the Isle of Man, where I lived for about a year. The Isle of Man has on its flag one of the weirdest national symbols in Europe, that three-legged thingy that's called a trinacria in Latin and the triskelion in Manx Gaelic. It looks a little like a swastika, but it isn't. It's three legs encased in armor. There are all kinds of legends and stories as to the origin of this symbol, but my favorite is the one about St. Columba, who was the second patron saint of Ireland after Patrick. Anyway, St. Columba came to the Isle of Man many, you know, centuries ago, probably around 8th or 9th century, whatever, to convert the locals to Christianity, and he was challenged to a magical duel by a druid named Briocan. In the center of the Isle of Man is a huge mountain called Snaefell, from which, if you turn around in a circle, you can see, as the saying goes, six kingdoms. The Kingdom of Man, of England, Wales, Scotland, Ireland, and the Kingdom of Heaven. And so you can. They have a train that goes to the top. I've been up on it, and you can indeed see bits and pieces of England, Wales, Scotland, and Ireland all at once. Anyway, according to legend, after all kinds of Gandalf and Sauron-like sorcery stuff, the druid Briocan went up on top of Snaefell and conjured up this big, huge, monstrous thing consisting of three legs in armor connected at the hip, and it went rolling down the great mountainside towards St. Columba, where, according to which version of the story you believe, either St. Columba destroyed it with a prayer and a dash of holy water, or else it smushed him. Not that it did much good as far as the islanders were concerned, since they were eventually converted to Christianity anyway, but somehow or other, that triskelion, that three-legged symbol, became the emblem of the Isle of Man, and you can still see it on the flag today. This piece is from the Celtic Music Festival at Lorient, France, and it's about the great magical contest between Briocan and Columba. This is Sean Davey and the Glasgow City Orchestra. Okay, I'm going to have to go off script here and ad-lib the rest of this episode because something has come up which is going to demand almost all of my time tomorrow, which is Thursday, and I won't be able to work on the show, and that means that I have to get this episode up on to the site tonight, which is Wednesday, and that in turn means I don't have time to sit down and type out a script, so I'm just going to have to try to wing it and see what happens. I promised you guys last week that on this week's Radio Free Northwest, I would go over the subject of personal recruiting for the Northwest Front and the arts and sciences involved in slipping past the enemy's radar and the automatic rejection mechanism, which has been socially engineered into all white people from birth in the 20th and 21st centuries. But before I do that, I need to go over something else while I'm thinking about it. And that is our need for a new range of small handheld items like leaflets, stickers, business cards, brochures, so forth and so on. Little guys, as some people call them back in the old days. Now, you may remember a few minutes ago I was talking about how we're going to lose the internet someday. Well, if and when we lose the internet, or even if we don't anytime soon, we are going to still need large quantities of small handheld items of propaganda in order to use in personal face-to-face one-on-one recruiting, which is really how we're going to have to do it until such time as we can break into the establishment media and start generating some actual positive publicity in the system, news media on TV and the papers, whatnot, and so forth. Now, these items need to be not only clear and convincing in their content, racially and politically, they need to be professional in appearance, and if possible, they need to contain bright colors and as many pictures as possible. I love some of these color brochures and color cards that some of the groups have done on nice, heavy, glossy stock. The little three-page fold-over brochures, like a travel brochure. We need to start getting a lot of that kind of stuff for the Northwest Front. Now, those of you who have received your introductory packets of literature from the party will be aware of the fact that we do include a number of 1- and 2-page leaflets in the intro pack, as well as a business card or two. Sometimes I will go ahead and send a white book. That's another thing that's going to have to be done fairly soon. The white book's going to have to be updated, and when we do that, I want to actually have the white book professionally printed and not done galley style and hand-bound like it is now, but that's another topic. Anyway, these leaflets that we send out in the introductory pack are all there for a specific reason, in that they cover some topic or some idea that I think needs to be covered with new people. And in some cases, they serve as an introduction to ideas that new people may never have come into contact with before. I actually have those leaflets here in front of me now. Okay, the first thing I see here is the Fundamental Principles of Northwest Migration. That's the 5-point basic leaflet that explains what Northwest Migration is all about. Obviously, that needs to go in the intro pack so that people know what the hell we're talking about. I see the program of the Northwest Front. Now, this is a very simplified version of our program. It's been condensed to fit onto 1 page of an 8.5 by 11 sheet and still being a fairly readable type size. So you can see that this can't exactly be all that complex, but it gives people an idea of what the Northwest Front itself as a movement is about. Now, the next thing I see here is A Purpose in Life, which is an old NSWPP leaflet from back in the Kale days, and this gets into the spiritual aspect of white nationalism, at least lets new people know that there is a spiritual aspect to it. Starts out, life without purpose is mere existence, and as such it has no meaning or value. It is worthless. It's of no consequence, it doesn't count, and most people exist today as mere protoplasmic blobs, which they do, and it just goes on and on. Anyway, most of you will have seen that leaflet, of course, and you can read your own copies. Then there's the White and Proud leaflet that tells white people that they do have a heritage and a race to be proud of. I think that's one of the worst things that the Jews have done to our people, young people especially. They've made them ashamed of being white. A lot of people, until they receive our introductory packet, will never even have heard the term white and proud. They will never have believed that being white was something to be proud of. So that definitely needs to be in there. And finally, we have, for the 8.5 by 11s, we have the red lines, acceptable limits of white nationalist behavior. Unfortunately, a lot of our introductory packets go out to people who do have movement backgrounds. They've been kind of contaminated by their association with previous movement groups, VNN, whatever. And they definitely need to know that there are red lines, that there are things that are just not acceptable for white nationalist groups to do. Okay, we go on to the larger leaflets. In the intro packet, there's also a number of 8.5 by 14 legal size leaflets. I use that size and also a smaller typeface because this is where we have to actually sort of get some information in here. These are actually small pamphlets. And so the result is that in some of these cases, they're kind of in small type, but the idea gets through. The first is, why are the Jews persecuted? Now, this is vitally necessary for a new person to understand. Many of the people who write to us have never actually seen any kind of exposition or explanation of the Jewish problem. They're not even aware that there is a Jewish problem. So that's absolutely vital that that goes into the packet. And then I see the 14 words of David Lane. This is something, obviously, that everyone needs to know if they're going to be involved with the Northwest Migration. They need to know who David Lane is. And above all, of course, they need to know those 14 words. So there has to be an introduction to the 14 words in that packet. And then I have Confessions of a Bigot. Now, this is an old piece that was written by a guy in Chicago whose neighborhood kept getting overrun by niggers. And it's an introduction to the racial issue. A lot of people, believe it or not, have never actually thought about the racial issue as such. They know that they don't really like blacks, and they don't really know why. For many people, this will be the first actual racial commentary on niggers they've ever seen, so that needs to be in the packet. And then I get the Northwest Volunteer Army General Orders, which are officially an advertisement for the brigade, but, of course, in actual practice, they get people to thinking subversive thoughts, and we need a little bit of subversive thought in the party. And then we get our Homecoming Etiquette and Expectations. I was just going to sit and read this leaflet, but I won't do that because it's a bit long. It's written by April Gady, and it tells people what we expect of them when they do come home, and that also is very worthwhile, etc. Now, as I've said, all of these leaflets have a specific purpose in being in the introductory pack, and they're all quite good so far as they go, but they all have a similar problem, which might make them not as suitable as they might be for public distribution in mass. These leaflets are in black and white, and they consist mostly of text, and only one of them has any kind of picture on it. That's the program of the Northwest Front that has the party seal. Now, these days, that's not the best presentation possible because it is a simple fact that a large number of white Americans of the 21st century, especially young white Americans, are functionally illiterate. Okay, they can read. Technically, they can read short sentences and short words. They can read traffic signs. They can read the TV guide. They can understand what they see on TV and on websites, since whatever writing is on the electronic screen is assisted by visual images and pictures. But the fact is that many Americans, especially young white boys and girls, either never learned or have lost the ability to read a block of text for content. God, how I miss the old days when it was all done with newspapers. I think it's significant that most of Europe's revolutions during the early 20th century were centered around cafes, where both right-wing and left-wing radicals sat around sipping on coffee or Russian tea and read all the newspapers. And of course, any decent cafe in Vienna or Paris or Geneva subscribed and carried about 20 or 30 major newspapers from all over Europe and from every viewpoint. They were better than libraries. Everybody from Lenin and Trotsky to Mussolini to Adolf Hitler to A.K. Chesterton and Ezra Pound got their first political and racial educations from reading blocks of type in books and newspapers. No more, unfortunately. The electronic screen is king. It's kind of like white people who started out inventing writing by drawing animals on the walls of caves back in the Paleolithic age, and we're now reverting back to that primitive state of illiteracy, but instead of the cave wall, they have to see their pictures on electronic screens of computers and television sets. I'm actually amazed and proud that I've gotten as many young white people to sit down and read my novels as I have done. Okay, I'll stop gassing on now and get on with what I wanted to say. The party needs a whole new selection of material. Small, handheld stuff. Professional in appearance. Brightly colored. With as many pictures as possible. And not so much for the first contact in the introductory packet, but for face-to-face work. One-on-one organizing and that's the way we're going to be doing most of it until such time as we can get some responsible establishment media publicity. The first contact for many years that most people have with the Northwest Front will most likely be from someone who is in the front and who approaches them or talks to them or gives them a piece of literature or gives them a copy of the brigade or whatever. Our people who are doing recruiting and local work need small items that they can carry around with them, that they can stuff their pockets with. They can stuff a backpack full of stickers or cards or small half-page leaflets and go out and do a distribution, whatever. Now, this stuff needs to be not only right on the money, racial content-wise, but it has to be short, punchy, simple, and attractive to people who are simple and punchy and who have short attention spans. Now, we don't have an actual general headquarters yet, and so we can't distribute this stuff gratis in large amounts. I send out the leaflets and the intro packs on white paper so you can actually go to Kinko's and make copies of those if you want to distribute some of those leaflets that we do send out with the intro pack. And if you want to do that, by all means. I'm sure some of it could be quite to the point, like, for example, the fundamentals of Northwest Migration and the Northwest Front Program. The leaflets on, you know, the Jews and so forth and so on as well are very good and would serve to get people introduced to the Jewish question. But basically, we need some better stuff. We need to unleash our own creativity on this problem. I'd like to see a sort of a contest develop here and to see who can design the best business card, the best sticker, the best leaflet, the best poster. We need to start increasing our repertoire, so to speak, our inventory of propaganda ideas, and we need to have this stuff not just on the internet, because not every organizer is sitting in a computer and he can't, you know, physically direct people to websites. He needs to hand them something, a leaflet, a small pamphlet. I'd love to get, you know, those little Christian comic books that you find on bus seats and in post offices and littered around in the grocery store, those little tiny comics. I'd love to get something like that done for the Northwest Front, but you get the idea, folks. I would like to hear from all of you, and I would like to see your ideas, your designs for everything small and handheld, stickers, cards, leaflets. Now, we also, again, let me remind you, now have a storefront on the party website. We've got two cafe press sources, and they can provide you with NVA coffee mugs, Northwest Front t-shirts, Northwest Front gym bags, tricolor flag, baseball caps, everything you need by way of knickknacks and so forth and so on. And I'm actually going, I think, to be stocking up on a lot of that stuff and send them out as Christmas gifts. And that might be an idea for you guys as well. There's nothing that says ho, ho, ho and Merry Christmas like an NVA coffee mug. Okay, so look, I tell you what, I'm going to go ahead and take a third music break right now. Here's another song for our Canadian comrades. This is a man who, in my opinion, was Canada's greatest folk singer during the 20th century, the late Stan Rogers with Barrett's Privateers.
Oh, the year was 1778. How I wish I was in Sherbrooke now. A letter of marque came from the king to the scummiest vessel I've ever seen. God damn them all. I was told we'd cruise the seas for American gold. We'd fire no guns, shed no tears. Now I'm a broken man on a Halifax pier, the last of Barrett's privateers. Oh, well, said Barrett, cried the town, how I wish I was in Sherbrooke now. For 20 brave men, all fishermen, who would make for him the Antelope's crew? God damn them all. I was told we'd cruise the seas for American gold. We'd fire no guns, shed no tears. Now I'm a broken man on a Halifax pier, the last of Barrett's privateers. The Antelope sloop was a sickening sight. How I wish I was in Sherbrooke now. She'd a list to the port and her sails in rags, and the cook in the scuppers with the staggers and jags. God damn them all. I was told we'd cruise the seas for American gold. We'd fire no guns, shed no tears. Now I'm a broken man on a Halifax pier, the last of Barrett's privateers. On the king's birthday we put to sea. How I wish I was in Sherbrooke now. We were 91 days to Montego Bay, pumping like madmen all the way. God damn them all. I was told we'd cruise the seas for American gold. We'd fire no guns, shed no tears. Now I'm a broken man on a Halifax pier, the last of Barrett's privateers. On the 96th day we sailed again. How I wish I was in Sherbrooke now. When a bloody great Yankee hove in sight, with our cracked 4-pounders we made to fight. God damn them all. I was told we'd cruise the seas for American gold. We'd fire no guns, shed no tears. Now I'm a broken man on a Halifax pier, the last of Barrett's privateers. The Yankee lay low down with gold. I wish I was in Sherbrooke now. She was broad and fat and loose in stays, but to catch her took me antelope 2 whole days. God damn them all. I was told we'd cruise the seas for American gold. We'd fire no guns, shed no tears. Now I'm a broken man on Halifax pier, the last of Barrett's privateers. Then at length we stood 2 cables away. How I wish I was in Sherbrooke now. Our cracked 4-pounders made an awful din, but with 1 fat ball the Yanks stove us in. God damn them all. I was told we'd cruise the seas for American gold. We'd fire no guns, shed no tears. Now I'm a broken man on a Halifax pier, the last of Barrett's privateers. The antelope shook and pitched on her side. How I wish I was in Sherbrooke now. Barrett was smashed like a bowl of eggs, and the main truck carried off both men eggs. God damn them all. I was told we'd cruise the seas for American gold. We'd fire no guns, shed no tears. Now I'm a broken man on a Halifax pier, the last of Barrett's privateers. So here I lay in my 23rd year. How I wish I was in Sherbrooke now. It's been 6 years since we sailed away, and I just made Halifax yesterday. God damn them all. I was told we'd cruise the seas for American gold. We'd fire no guns, shed no tears. Now I'm a broken man on a Halifax pier, the last of Barrett's privateers.
White Americans are not just illiterate as far as their own language goes. They're politically illiterate as well. They don't understand how the system really works and, generally speaking, don't want to. They just assume, correctly, that politics in this country is completely corrupt from top to bottom. That intelligent they are. Most of our people can, indeed, see a church by daylight, as Shakespeare said. But beyond that overpowering cynicism, which is based on practical experience, white Americans are the most politically unsophisticated people on earth. Through several generations of television, Hollywood movies, disco music, the internet, and every other kind of mental and social indoctrination the Jews can come up with, every white American has been fitted with a kind of mental and intellectual straitjacket from birth, with a pair of blinders like they used to put on cart and carriage horses to make sure that they saw only what was in front of them and couldn't be distracted by anything going on off the path or the road that their masters wanted them to travel. Many white Americans believe all this liberal claptrap for the simple reason that it's what they've heard all their lives. They've never been exposed to any other point of view, and so they just assume in the absence of critical comment or discussion that it all must be true. And when you meet somebody new, there's a good chance that their personal opinions, such as they are, will be liberal orthodoxy, because of what I just said about their never hearing anything else, and also because they understand that to question these orthodox and official ideas can get them in trouble and threaten their job, their money, and their material wealth. America doesn't really need secret police, although we have them in abundance. The private sector does the bulk of keeping our people in line through fear of losing wealth and employment and status, and fear of being marked as the other. And in this society, racially conscious white people are most definitely the other. The second important thing you have to remember is that whites have a kind of automatic, psychologically engineered, mental and emotional reflex that causes them to automatically reject anything that seems to be racially or politically incorrect. Sometimes when you drop the word nigger on them, you can actually see them physically jerk like they've been burned. No, that doesn't mean don't say nigger. You need to try it at least once or twice to see how they react, and if their minds are not completely under control by the system, that gives them a signal that it's safe to talk to you and be honest about what they feel. Most ordinary white people have also been brainwashed into an error that you'll find very commonly in our wee little movement itself, one that you'll run into time and again anytime you're trying to convert and energize local people for the Northwest Republic. You may find them willing to listen and even agree in theory, but almost never willing to take any action because they don't really believe in their hearts that anything can be done. A large number of ordinary white people have actually come to accept in a number of subtle ways that our race is doomed and that nothing can be done about it. And anyone who tries will just get in trouble and get themselves and their families hurt. And since Americans have been raised always to put number one first, that's going to be a hard obstacle to overcome. Ordinary white people don't like what they do know about race. In fact, it pisses most of them off, some to the point where they will call Rush Limbaugh and complain, and some to the point where they'll get drunk in a bar and complain. But they have a kind of built-in safety mechanism that stops them from going too far before they get in trouble. The one thing the white American has been ingrained from birth to avoid is quote-unquote getting into trouble. I don't mean silly childish stuff like you see on the Jackass show. White boys are actually encouraged to do that kind of nonsense. I mean real trouble, racial trouble. White Americans have been socially conditioned to react with almost hysterical fear and avoidance to anything racial at all. Now, when you mess with that safety mechanism, when you tinker with it, when you try and disable it like any alarm system, you run the risk of accidentally tripping the very alarm you're trying to shut off, so you have to be very careful. The first thing you do is to learn to size people up quickly. Assess, for example, a white prospect's economic status. Now remember, money is the shield that America provides to white people to protect and cushion them from the realities of race. And the less they have of it, the more likely they are to be receptive. Now true, there are some wealthy people who do support white nationalism from time to time out of conscience or knowledge or faith, thank God. But as a rule of thumb, the more wealthy someone is and the more they have to lose, the less likely they are to be interested in shaking up the status quo. And remember, American white boys have been raised from birth to be narcissists and to look out for number one first. They're what's called risk-averse in yuppie speak. Now, a white man can overcome that. Remember, his chromosomes are the same as his Viking and his pioneer ancestors. And we've only had about 50 or so years of this liberal brainwashing, so we all have it in us to be brave and to break the Jewish conditioning. But if you trip that particular alarm bell and a prospect senses risk to himself, or more importantly to his money and his material wealth, he'll probably bolt on you out of sheer reflexive self-preservation instinct. The first step is to put yourself on a credible basis of communication with your prospective recruits by making them like and respect you personally. If someone respects you, they'll respect your opinion. You need to avoid appearing in any way strange or eccentric or violent or even overly enthusiastic. Now, this is why I'm always concerned about some of the things that certain representatives of our cause, mostly self-appointed representatives of our cause, indulge in. Things like tattoos, excessive drinking, drugs, excessive profanity, wild talk about illegal activity, wild speculation about political conspiracies, mixing racial politics with things like religion and UFOs and paranormal research, that kind of thing. If ordinary people think you are odd or nutty, then they'll think your racial and your political views are odd or nutty. The local NF representative needs to come off as just one of the guys. Don't talk down or preach to your prospects. Listen to them, especially at first, when you first meet them. Learn what makes them tick. Learn about their families. Learn about their past. Learn about their problems, about their job, about their problems on the job, so forth and so on. Assess their character. This is not just so you can decide whether or not to recruit them in the first place, but it's also so you can figure out what approach to use best. Don't try to educate them. Get them curious, get them thinking, and let them come to you to be educated. The final thing you need to understand is that liberal brainwashing and Jewish mind control is never completely effective, largely because it's wrong. The things that these people are telling us about race and about politics and about the Jews and about the economy and about our place in the world and so on, all these things are wrong. And they can be seen to be wrong every day by anyone with two brain cells to rub together. So their mojo is never totally effective, even in the strongest liberals. And it's less and less so in times like these, when no one has any money anymore and whites can no longer be rewarded with wealth and comfort for looking the other way. A politically correct society is rapidly losing its carrot, and pretty soon all that's going to be left is the stick. More and more white Americans now understand viscerally, truly, that something is badly wrong in society, and that what they've been told all their lives about certain people, certain events, and certain subjects is a lie. Now, that'll make them mad. and that'll also make them curious. They're going to want to know the truth. In casual conversation and a dozen other ways, you need to make your prospective recruit understand that you have the answers. Or if you don't, you can send him to somebody who does. If you can get him interested and use his anger and frustration to get him to embark on an inner quest, a search for answers as to why things are the way they are, he will voluntarily turn off a lot of his internal alarm systems and rejection mechanisms himself. The one sure way to get into a house that's wired with all kinds of burglar alarms is to be invited in. That's the basic trick to it, guys. Don't try to break or force your way into someone else's mind and conscience. Persuade them to invite you in. Now, moving on to the specifics. Every individual case is unique. I mean, the stories about how we all come to where we've been in the movement and politically, racially, personally, spiritually, everyone has a different story. But I find that it really helps to keep some kind of racial propaganda on hand at all times, where you can get at it quickly, even if it's on the job, so you can strike when the iron is hot, even if it's only a business card, so you can get somebody to go to the website. There's been a lot of discussion in the past over the best first literature piece to present someone with. Okay, hopefully after a while we should have our own introductory literature specifically designed for hand-to-hand, or you can, of course, use one or more of our existing party leaflets that I've just described to you. Like I said, I deliberately run them off on white paper with black text so anyone with access to a copy machine can make as many as he wants. It's a damn pity we don't have Dr. Fields' Truth at Last newspaper still around today, but all things considered, you might want to try starting a new prospect off light with Willis Cardo's American Free Press. That's a weekly tabloid newspaper. It's published out of Washington, D.C. For those of you who know who Willis Cardo is, well, you know who Willis Cardo is, and if you don't, you can Google him. I think it's worth a subscription, though, just so you can pass your own copy of each weekly issue on to others. American Free Press is about as hard conservative as you can get, with very distinct racial elements, and also Cardo is solid on the Jewish question. I think AFP is especially good at getting Tea Party types started on the road to racial epiphany. If you want something stronger and heavier, you can try giving someone my two nonfiction books, Dreaming the Iron Dream and The March Up Country. As to the first full book you give out, if you can get a prospect actually to read a whole book, that is, well, there's always Northwest Novels, but you know what I've always recommended as the very first full racial book that anyone should read? White Power by Commander Rockwell. Even though it is kind of dated by now since it was written in 1967, the basic principles that the commander covers are timeless. And my experience has always been that if White Power can't bring somebody around, even if only in his own personal thinking and worldview, then you're wasting your time with a guy anyway. Well, our time is up, and so that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington, 98194. Or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha Andaban. Freedom.